Okay, so that's the title. We are interested in trying to describe flowing granular media. I've sort of put up a non-exhaustive list of configurations here. And the goal is actually to get constitutive relations, you know, something like Navier-Stokes equations, which we can somehow plug into any geometry and get solutions out. It turns out we still haven't gotten there, at least from the engineering perspective. And there are various reasons for that. I thought I'd just briefly give you my perspective of why that is so. Firstly, it's a driven dissipative system. That is, you need to put in energy for the thing to flow. Okay, there's no underlying temperature. And the fact that there's no underlying temperature also means there's no linear regime. Okay, you cannot have do a linear response about a thermodynamic equilibrium state. Okay, basically, the state of the system is determined by a balance between the source of energy and the dissipation of energy. Okay, the energy dissipation mechanisms usually analyzed are inelastic collisions, friction, and so on. We've spent a lot of time trying to consider fluid drag as well. But these energy dissipation mechanisms are more or less isotropic in the sense that they aren't sensitive to directionality. That is, a collision is going to dissipate energy regardless of how it's oriented.
When you say fluid drag, do you mean that you consider the air component as well?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay. The problem is that the driving mechanism is not sort of isotropic. It has, if you apply a mean shear, the strain rate has a tensorial nature to it. There are body forces which act in various directions and they drive the flow, for example, in inclined planes. Turbulent fluctuations due to gas flow can affect induced particle fluctuations as well as forcing at boundaries. This is the sort of thing I'll talk about. But the problem is that somehow that energy source mechanism has to be incorporated into any hydrodynamic description that you can think of. So it's not like a complex fluid where the anisotropy comes in due to the structure of the fluid itself. Okay, the anisotropy is coming in due to the driving mechanism. And so if you define something like a temperature, which is a mean square velocity, that itself is anisotropic. And material properties such as viscosity, thermal conductivity, etc., depend upon this driving mechanism. So all of these are also anisotropic. And if you try to do the usual decay rate of fluctuations kind of analysis that you do close to equilibrium, you'll get decay rates that are non-analytic in the sense that they aren't just dissipative or propagating. Just briefly, these are the results of some calculations we've done on shear flows. I'll just make a digression here before I go into vibrofluidized beds. So if you have a shear flow of a granular material, neglect gravity, the fluctuations are due to the mean shear. If you had a normal fluid, you'd have a mode structure for the conserved variables that consists of two shear modes, which decay as the wave vector square. There are two propagating modes with real and imaginary parts that go as the wave vector, wave number, and two, and the dissipative part goes as k square, and there's an energy dissipation part also that goes as k square. Now, the same calculation if you do for a shear granular material, it turns out that the decay rate of fluctuations is going to depend upon what direction you're considering, that is, what direction the modes are in. In the flow direction, you get k power 2/3 for the shear modes and k square, so this is unstable in the long wave limit. Propagating modes also go as k power 2/3, and the energy mode is damped because collisions dissipate energy. The gradient direction looks very similar to a real fluid, but the surprise is that the vorticity direction once again looks very strange. Okay, the propagating modes in particular don't have any imaginary parts. Okay, so
can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Is it the results of your theory, or it's well known to everybody? This table is a nice summary, but is it the result of some particular model?
No, it's the result. Yeah, no, these are inelastic spheres in a shear flow.
Right, yeah, but the results, is this general in the literature, or is this my theory? Okay.
No, I won't tell you about this, but I just want to point it out. That
you're going to tell us how you calculate that.
No.
I think public might actually like to hear about this.
No, this was a brief digression to just illustrate what the difficulties are.
Those are dangerous.
So I don't have slides on that. Maybe if people are interested, I can do it later. My main topic was something else.
Advertise a blackboard time at some point and just say what you're going to do.
Yeah, so these are results, yeah.
Could you say one sentence on where the results come from?
This, the two-third power is quite easy. It comes from kinematic considerations. That is, if you have concentration diffusion in a shear flow, right, you can get analytical solutions. Okay, so if you solve the convection diffusion equation in a shear flow, right, the wave vector is being convected by the flow. Okay, so you can get analytical solutions for the decay rate of fluctuations. The leading order solution will be proportional to dk squared times p. Okay, which is the usual diffusive mode, but there's a third term that goes as gamma dot k squared t cubed. Okay, where gamma dot is the strain rate. So that's where the two-third power comes from. The vorticity direction is much more complicated. It's actually driven by dissipative effects. Okay, so I cannot give you a simple explanation straight away for that. Okay, but yeah, these are analytical results. Yeah. Okay. I mean, we do similar things for inclined planes and various other things. Turbulent diffusion is a big issue for us. So we
can you just give one more sentence, which is the status of those results with respect to either simulation or experiment?
This one? Simulations, yes. Experiments, no. Okay.
And simulations, you see all of that stuff?
Yeah. But this was supposed to be a brief digression. My main results, which I'll present, well, I thought physicists would be more interested in vibrated beds, so I thought I'll focus on that. Okay. It's well known that these things exhibit complex behavior. I'm sure you've all seen the covers of Nature and Science and so on. They form these oscillons and various squares and stripes and various other things. And simulations by now have established that all of those complex behavior result from simple microscopic interactions. Okay, if you just had hard spheres which collide in such a way that they lose a fraction of their relative velocity in a collision, where E is the coefficient of restitution, you can recover all of those patterns that make pretty pictures, okay, in simulations. Okay, theoretically, once again, there have been various approaches. Most of the approaches have nothing to do with the underlying dynamics of the system. Okay, most of them are start from some kind of a Landau-Ginzburg type of approximation with some order parameter, and then they get all of these patterns. Okay, I guess that sort of shows that these patterns are the result are universal across a large class of models. They are not specific to one particular type, that is granular flows. Okay. But if you take a look at the Landau-Ginzburg models, you know, the way they're done is with some kind of a free energy functional which has an attractive part and then a repulsive part far away, okay, as a function of this concentration field. A hard sphere gas does not have phase coexistence, okay, because there is no energy scale in the system, okay, so there's going to be no transition between phases for a hard sphere gas. So you've got to get this this microscopic behavior, which acts like a Landau-Ginzburg model, from some microscopic dynamics that does not show phase coexistence. Okay, and I think that was what sort of motivated us to start looking at this problem. Okay, so what we decided to do was to look at very simple configurations. Let's not worry about let's make the system as dilute as possible so that we don't have to worry about high density effects. Let's decouple the dynamics from the vibrating wall dynamics. So we always consider situations where the frequency of collisions of particles with the walls is much lower than the frequency of the wall vibration itself. And let's see if we can do some basic theory and compare with experiments and see how good it is. Where does it fail, and where it fails, why it does so. Okay, so that was the basic.
Can I ask a question? Is the coefficient of restitution for the relative velocity or for the energy?
For the relative velocity.
Why is that?
I think standard. In hard sphere collisions, it's always for the relative velocity. I don't know.
It's just a question of invention. I'm saying your definition of the coefficient, if done in terms of velocity and done in terms of energy, will be slightly different. Be higher, somewhere.
If the masses are equal.
Yeah.
This
mass term we argued about last week.
Yeah.
Ah, yes.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's what we were indoctrinated with. So. I don't know. Does anyone have a better explanation for that?
The hard spirits, it's equivalent, just a question of how you define it. You put the 2 squared effectively.
The mass ratio business is where it confuses.
So one moves vertically?
Yeah, I'll come to the configuration. Yeah.
It's a very small oscillation?
It's a very small oscillation, yes. I'll come to
how small compared to the size of the
peak? It's 1 or 2 particle diameters, but it's small compared to mean free path.
Mean field?
To mean free path. Mean free path is the controlling parameter here. Okay.
So you said something about the frequency at which you're shaking it. It's much smaller than Much higher than?
Frequency of particle collisions.
I see.
Okay.
So that it's effectively random.
If it's effectively random, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you try to keep it in that limit to make it simple. Okay. So the method of analysis, okay, kinetic theory, you draw an analogy between the particle motion and the motion of molecules in a hard sphere gas. And the way we do it is to write down what is called a Boltzmann equation, okay, which essentially tells you how the distribution function varies both in position as well as in velocities. And the difficult part in this is what is called the collision integral, because you know, all of these terms are sort of gradient terms. They refer to the slow variation of the distribution function in space due to either motion of particles in real space with a velocity u, or due to motion in the velocity coordinates with acceleration a. Okay, this collision term actually accounts for the discontinuous change in velocity due to collisions between pairs of particles. When a particle pair collides, their velocity changes discontinuously. So you have particles either entering or leaving a location in this phase space. And this transport is non-local. In other words, it occurs over large distances in phase space, in the velocity coordinate. Okay, and that is a challenge because it's a non-local term. So strictly speaking, you cannot get a differential equation. You got to get a difference equation for this, okay, and solve it simultaneously. Okay, where this connects to thermodynamics is through the Boltzmann-Edge theorem. Okay, essentially what it states is that if the flow is steady and there are no gradients, then you can show that a balance for if the number of particles entering and leaving within a given volume in phase space is equal to zero, the net number of particles, then you can show that as a consequence, detailed balancing follows. That is, the number of particles leaving from one volume to the other is equal to the number of particles coming back. Okay, and then from energy conservation, you get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution can be derived dynamically without reference to the notion of equal probability of microscopic states. Okay, so it's a dynamical derivation, and so we don't have so this provides an avenue for analyzing systems which don't have an underlying equilibrium state. Okay,
all of that is provided you put in some form for the collision term.
Yes,
I mean, all of this flies only because of a clever guess for the collision term. Otherwise, it's not really
the
derivation.
Yeah, it is, right?
The H theorem, I'm saying, for instance.
The H theorem will work for any collision term that conserves energy. Okay, any collision integral that conserves energy and has only pair collisions between particles, the H theorem will work. Okay.
But here
we don't conserve energy. Yes.
So this doesn't hold.
So this doesn't hold. Right. So you've got to figure out some other way of doing this balance, okay, in the velocity coordinates. Right.
I'm just saying that in the Boltzmann, you know, classical Boltzmann transport equation for elastic things, it is because Boltzmann guessed, you know, a clever expression for the collision integral in this sort of funny decoupled way, you could make any progress. That's not a derivation from microscopics. It's based on putting in a clever collision term by hand.
Okay, there are two assumptions. One is that the pair distribution function is the product of single particle distributions.
Yes, I mean.
Okay, you can relax that by putting in a pair correlation function in front, which depends only upon the density.
It's a phenomenological
thing.
It's a big phenomenological step. It's fine. It works.
Yeah.
It gives you good answers and things. It's not a derivation.
Okay, we can argue about it later. Okay. So, so, So in this case, what we were looking for was, I got two axes here, okay? One is the nu c is the frequency of interparticle collisions, nu s the frequency of particle collisions with the wall, okay? So that ratio I'm plotting on the x-axis. On the y-axis, I'm plotting 1 minus e, which is the departure from elastic collisions, okay? So let's consider first the case where the frequency of interparticle collisions is large compared to the collisions with the surface, and you're close to an elastic limit, okay? Now, if the collisions were perfectly elastic, then this would be an elastic gas in a gravitational field, okay? And you know what the distribution is. The density distribution is a Boltzmann distribution that decays exponentially, and you know what the velocity distributions are. If you're close to that limit, you'd expect that the distribution function would be close to what you would get, so you can use some kind of a perturbation expansion about this state where you have a density that's decaying exponentially, okay, from the bottom to the top. You still don't know what the temperature is, okay, but the hope is that you can somehow get the temperature by balancing energy source and dissipation. Okay, if you go to this opposite limit where a particle collides many times with the bottom surface in between successive interparticle collisions, then of course you don't know what the distribution function is. Okay, you've got to have some way of determining it. So we have one case where the collisions are nearly elastic, which we can do some analysis with. And then the question is, what happens as you make the collisions more inelastic? What are the other things that develop? Okay, so I'll first consider this limit and then this limit, and then tell you what happens as we make the collisions more.
One question. The statement that it's near Maxwell-Boltzmann.
Yeah.
Is certainly going to be is likely to be true in the limit of perfectly elastic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite possible, right, that even if it's slightly inelastic, there's an order of limits thing in the sense that the distribution at long enough times, and how long that time is, how long a time depends on how inelastic things are, the distribution long enough times is always non-Maxwell-Boltzmann.
The distribution is a steady distribution, right? I mean, it doesn't evolve in time.
No, but in a given simulation, you'll have to wait a while.
Sure.
The point is that for arbitrarily small inelasticity, you could well have something that's totally non-Maxwell-Boltzmann.
Could be a singular perturbation.
Yeah.
Okay. It could be.
In fact, there are clear examples of that when people have studied this.
Right.
I mean, for instance, in that limit, it may not be quite the sort of system you're thinking of, but certainly if you just look at that parameter, the rate of collision versus heating, if you like, it is known that. That you get non-uniform spatial distributions, for instance, of particles, or density correlation functions, which would be clear violations of the Maxwell-Boltzmann, even when that ratio is fairly large.
So the question is how near it is. What do you mean by near?
We'll establish.
I think I would agree that it tends toward Maxwell-Boltzmann, but. You can still have non-uniform
Shatar,
for instance.
Oh, sure. Yes. I mean, that we'll establish as we go along. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so this is basically what you do in a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. We don't quite do this. We allow the temperatures to be different in different directions and so on. But the density pressure relationship is essentially given by the fact that the rate of change of pressure is equal to density times gravity. And P is equal to P of rho, we get by a modified equation of state for an ideal gas, which is modified to account for the inelasticity of the collisions. The temperature is as yet unknown in the leading order analysis. But
can you just slow down? So this is something you actually derive by solving the Maxwell-Boltzmann equation for the elastic case. And in an expansion in 1 minus e.
So temperature is given by a balance between how much energy a particle picks up when it collides with the wall and how much energy is lost in dissipation due to collisions with particles. Okay, so we do an average over the distribution function and get each of these. Okay, and as I said, we do an expansion, and that expansion is essentially what is called a moment distribution. Okay, so this is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and we keep up to third moments. Okay, all non-trivial solutions up to third moments, and then we solve for these moments from the Boltzmann equation itself. Okay, so that's
basically. How do you put the forcing into the boundary?
So if you didn't have any forcing for any arbitrarily small inelasticity,
yes, it collapses.
Zero.
Yes.
So
yes.
How are you putting that in? I mean, that's the sense in which this is singular, right? There's for E equals zero, your hard sphere gas, and for E equals one, your hard sphere gas.
No, but there's a relation. Yeah, but there's a relationship between source and dissipation, right? So you can tune only one of those independently. So if I fix E, then I know what the forcing is to get the steady state at a given temperature.
Yeah. Okay. So
yeah.
And
the way you get it,
you're not directly treating the vibration of the walls as mechanically, sort of treating that
not,
as the energy input.
No. We treat it mechanically in the sense that I have particles colliding and going up. Right. This wall is vibrating. Okay. So that the velocity, let's say the collision has a coefficient of restitution E y in the y direction. So you'll have the u y prime after collision is minus E u y, right? But this, not strictly speaking, u y, because the wall itself is vibrating, right? So what I should do is u y prime minus u is equal to E into u y minus u. Okay, so the wall vibration comes in here. Okay, and using this relation, I calculate what is the change in energy. Okay, and when I calculate the change in energy, I'll get functions that are linear as well as quadratic in U. Okay, the quadratic terms in U are the ones that are even; they'll give you the energy source. Okay, so you do an explicit average over the vibration of the wall.
Okay, so that's what I didn't understand.
Yeah. In practice, you just assume a given rate of energy input per particle.
No, we do this. I mean, we actually have a wall that vibrates, particles collide. The distribution function before and after collision are related by these relations between the velocities. From that, you can back out what is the energy input of a particle. And that, yeah.
So you average over a lot of such collisions. So it works best if you've got many, many such collisions per...
We do it analytically, right? You know what is the distribution of U. That is, we know P of U as a function of U. For a given, so let's say, sine wave or something like that, right? We can plot that, and we do an average over P of U.
P is
so
it's
like an average of the many cycles of the oscillation using time.
But just procedurally, you have a rate with which a collision is assumed to occur, and then you choose a U from that distribution function.
No. The rate at which collision occurs is essentially given by the rate at which particles collide, right? Which is equal to the density times the vertical velocity, right, per unit area.
I'm missing something. I mean, this is, if you were doing a simulation, I would understand what you've described here.
Okay.
But, I mean, in the theory, how do you connect this picture of collisions with,
First of all, it doesn't matter which particle collides.
Yeah.
So if you draw that sort of mean free path tube.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's how you calculate the pressure on a surface, right, in kinetic theory, right? You average over the distribution function times the velocity that gives you the flux on the surface, times the momentum interchange essentially gives you the pressure.
I guess what's a bit of a concern is that you don't know about history dependence for these things. You don't know, for instance, the, maybe this is too much of a digression, and maybe we'll
that's fine.
Continue later, but
you don't know about correlated collisions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, you don't know about correlated.
About those correlations, because those correlations can be very important in physical systems. In fact, they're generally much more important. So, I would understand this as an algorithm in a simulation, but to actually connect that with the calculation requires assumptions.
See, the correlations will affect only if the phase of the wall is somehow coupled to the phase at which particles are colliding.
I mean, after a collision, you have a high energy particle moving up in this layer of excited particles.
Well, it's not exactly a layer. I mean, it's got a continuous density varying upwards. I'll show you figures.
Yeah, okay. There's some region above the surface.
It's mostly,
You see, so there's an assumption in there that those correlations.
Yes.
And I guess I just wanted to understand.
Okay.
So when E is small,
yeah, when E is small. But yeah, so I mean, so what we do is we do simulations simultaneously, and these are event-driven simulations. So we compare simulations with theory. So simulations have all the correlations and stuff like that. Okay. I show you some sample results for epsilon is equal to 0.26. Epsilon is actually the ratio of okay. U naught square is the mean square velocity of the wall. Okay. T is the mean square velocity of the particles. Okay. Now, if the coefficient of restitution is close to 1, okay, right, then I told you that the amount of energy a particle picks up with the collision of, with the surface goes as this, right? Whereas the dissipation, so source goes as U naught square, okay? The dissipation goes as 1 minus E times T, okay? Because T is the energy of a particle and the amount of energy it loses in a collision goes as 1 minus E, okay? So you'll get U naught square by T going as 1 minus E, where 1 minus E is the departure from elastic collisions, except when this ratio becomes large, okay, because this was derived using expansion in 1 minus E. Okay. So that is a small parameter. It's supposed to be a small parameter in the theory. Okay. N sigma is the number of monolayers that you have at rest. Okay. And the red curve is the result that you get from the analysis with no adjustable parameters. This is actually the result that you get from simulation. And the agreement is quite good except very near the bottom, and that bottom is because a particle colliding with the bottom gets reflected off the surface. So the distribution function also gets reflected off the surface. Okay, and that results in some kind of discontinuity kind of thing over here. Okay, the green curve is the low density theory, assuming that the density pressure relationship is given by the ideal gas law. And it doesn't perform quite as well, but it captures the trends. Okay. And these are the fluxes that you derive. Okay. Once again, the lines are simulations, the points are theory. You see that there is a lot of scatter over here because when you calculate, because as you go to greater heights, what you find is that the number of particles becomes small. So it's difficult to do averages properly, okay, when you do in the simulations, which is where you get these large fluctuations here. But for most of the region, it seems to be performing quite well. Okay, so this once again at epsilon is equal to 0.26 and sigma is equal to 3. When you go to larger values of n sigma, which is the number of monolayers at rest, you run into serious problems. Okay. You can see that the points are the mean square velocity from the theory, whereas the lines are from the simulations. And the points actually show the mean square velocity is going through zero. Okay, so as the number of layers increases, there are serious problems with the theory. Okay, and you can sort of do a comparison. That is, you take the relative error between the temperature you would predict from theory and what you get from simulations. Okay, and that seems to increase the That seems to increase roughly linearly with the number of layers. Okay.
Is this a specific point or average overall?
Average over the entire thing. Yeah. Okay. And it seems to increase linearly with number of layers. So our expansions are not good even when the number of layers becomes large, even though this parameter epsilon is still small. Okay. And I'll come back to why that is so a little later.
I mean, 0.26 is a fairly large.
Yes. Yes.
I would say that was a very large
epsilon
energy loss.
Yes.
You're better if you see improvements in the group as you expect as epsilon goes to zero.
As epsilon goes to zero, as E goes to one. Yeah. I have some plots in the very dilute limit and they sort of fall right on top of each other. Yeah. Okay, so
you get the same breakdown with the layer of height.
Yes. You get the same breakdown with layer heights, but there's another breakdown when the height becomes very small, and I'll tell you why that is a little later. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that was when the frequency of particle collisions with each other is large compared to frequency of collisions with the surface. What happens in the opposite limit, where the frequency of collisions between particles is small compared to the frequency of collisions with the surface? Okay. In this case, you think you'd get a leading order, you just neglect collisions between particles. Okay, and then you have a particle that is jumping on a surface that is vibrating. This has actually been done a lot in the context of dynamical systems where they see various period doublings and various things. What we were interested in is what is the steady distribution that develops when the mean square velocity of the particle is large compared to the mean square velocity of the surface, and where there is no correlation between the phase of the surface and the particle colliding with the surface. Okay, the mean square velocity of the particle is large compared to the mean square velocity of the surface for 1 minus e small compared to 1, okay, as I showed you in that argument. Okay, so. And you can sort of think of two different things. One is a symmetric surface, which looks something like this. That is, it has an amplitude that is symmetric about 0. Asymmetric surface looks something like this. Okay. So when a particle collides with the surface, its velocity changes, as I've shown over there. Okay. The velocity after collision relative to the surface is equal to e times the velocity before collision relative to the surface. Okay. So if you can see what happens, the particle which starts with an initial positive velocity, due to gravitational effects, the velocity decreases until it hits the surface. At this point, there's a discontinuous change. It comes back down, hits, and goes up again. Okay. So statistically, you can define a probability of finding a particle within an interval dUy about velocity ui at the surface. Okay, and you can plot the probability distribution function as a function of the velocity of the particles. Okay. Now, what these collisions are going to do is that if a particle that was initially here comes down, hits the surface, and then it gets a velocity ui double prime, okay, it comes back and hits the surface and gets a velocity ui prime. This collision process essentially transferred the particle from ui double prime to ui prime, okay, in the velocity coordinates. Okay. And so there should be a balance between the number of particles that are ejected from here and the number of particles that enter here. Okay, so that is the flux balance condition. Okay, there's no detailed balancing in this, okay, for obvious reasons. So this is actually a difference equation. Okay, you can convert it into a differential equation if u is small compared to ui double prime. Okay, that is if t is large compared to the velocity of the particles. Okay. Sorry, velocity of the surface. So we expand in this epsilon, which is 1 minus e, and average over all possible values of u. Assume there's no correlation in u at successive collisions. And you'll get a differential equation, which has a term that's proportional to the average of u and proportional to the average square of u. Okay. This term is non-zero if the amplitude is asymmetric. Okay. So that a particle is colliding only when the surface is going upwards, for example. Okay. This term is on average zero if you have a sinusoidal wave, for example. But this term is non-zero. Okay. So those essentially gives you the dominant balances. And you can solve that equation, and you find that the distribution function is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for a symmetric amplitude, okay, with a temperature which you can predict, okay, just from the analysis. If it's asymmetric, you get something that looks like a bimodal distribution with a mean as well as a variance which you can predict for each of these nodes. Okay, so that's the result. Yeah.
Leading order, this is what this is nearly elastic. Right?
Nearly elastic. Epsilon is 1 minus e. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You actually get Maxwell-Boltzmann for the which component? The vertical component.
Vertical component. Yes. Yeah. So horizontal component is 0. Right. Because you lose energy, you lose horizontal energy every time it collides. So the steady state has to be where the horizontal component is zero, right? Because 1 minus e is small, right?
There is going to be an asymmetry even in the.
There will be an asymmetry, but that is going to be higher order. Okay, so this analysis is valid only for when ui is large compared to u. Okay, as you come closer and closer, ui becomes of order u, then of course the collision of the particle with the surface is going to be correlated with the collision with the vibration of the surface itself. At that point, this analysis will fail. Okay.
So it's not even as a function of ui itself.
Yeah.
If this approximation isn't uniform, so near ui equals zero.
It has to fail, right?
It deviates from.
Yeah. Yes. The test is whether ui at other points it's six. And these are comparisons with simulations. This is a symmetric base amplitude. This is the Gaussian that the theory predicts. And you can see at epsilon is equal to 0.7, it's very far off. But by the time you come to 0.1 and 0.01, which are the white and the yellow curves here, you can see the yellow one is quite faithfully following this curve, except very near, where it failed because ui was of the same order as u. So that is for a symmetric base amplitude, and the same thing holds for an asymmetric base amplitude as well. The yellow ones are 0.01, and they are quite, and they follow quite nicely. Then the green ones, which is okay, it's considering that there are no adjustable parameters. But at 0.7, there is marked deviation. You can also do this the same calculation, assuming that the dissipation is not due to the inelasticity of the particle collision with the wall, but rather due to some drag force that is acting on the particles. And there it turns out that the distribution function is not a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution.
The interparticle collision is still inelastic?
There's no interparticle collision because it's a single particle.
Oh, so this is a single particle.
So in that case, it turns out that this is very different from a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. But still, you see good agreement when this epsilon goes very close to zero. So this for a single particle. You can then do interactions between pairs of particles, in the dilute limit, where the number of particles times the diameter, there's a number of monolayers divided by epsilon is small compared to 1. Essentially, what a pair collision between a pair of particles is going to do is that originally these particles were distributed Gaussianly along ui, but there was no distribution along ux. So it was just delta function in the ui ux plane. What a collision is going to do is to give a non-zero ux component to the velocity. So it's going to eject particles out. Then after that, they're going to start to come back in, because they collide with the wall many times, and their velocity comes back to zero. And you can do the distribution function in that case as well. It turns out that it diverges in the ux coordinate as c times delta, where delta is the small parameter, c is a constant, -1, times this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So this is, it's singular, but it's still integrable, just barely integrable. So that is the analytical expression for the distribution function. And also the distribution is highly skewed in the sense that ux squared goes as delta, whereas ux cubed also goes as delta. So if it were a Maxwell-Boltzmann, this would go as delta per 3/2. So it's a highly skewed distribution.
Your plot of the distribution doesn't look skewed.
Yes?
Right.
Yes, doesn't look skewed.
It's just a sketch.
Sorry, what am I saying? This is UY cubed, This is UY cubed.
Okay.
It has to be symmetric in the X direction. And I've seen experiments that actually show something like this. These are experiments of Olofsson and Urbach, which actually show this. This is a Gaussian distribution. This is what we predict in the second limit, and this is what they see in the experiments. Something like that. I haven't seen any simulation results on this limit yet. So now what happens as you increase the dissipation? In these simulations, we took care to ensure that the dissipation is small. So these are simulation results for an increase in dissipation. Epsilon is still defined as u0 squared by t, and it's proportional to 1 minus e. It's no half here. And for epsilon small compared to 1, the dissipation in a collision is small compared to the particle energy. N sigma is the number of monolayers at rest. And if n sigma is large, that means the frequency of interparticle collisions is large compared to the frequency of wall collisions. We took care to ensure that the area fraction at the bottom in two-dimensional simulations was always kept small. So high density effects don't play an important role. Okay, wall amplitude is always small compared to mean free path. Okay, so the phase of the wall doesn't matter. The wall frequency is always large compared to mean free path. Okay, so the phase at which the particle collides doesn't really affect. So the particle dynamics is essentially decoupled from the wall dynamics. And the acceleration ratio, if you write as A omega squared by G, okay, is large compared to 1. Okay, so we just have discrete particles colliding with the surface. Okay, we don't have a situation where the surface throws particles up and then comes down faster than the particles, so that the particles get ejected. Okay, so. And the departure from the non-uniform state, I'll show by plots of this, which is the difference between the actual number of particles and the average number of particles, okay, in the bed. So this is what you see. The top plot is a streamline plot. The bottom is a density shaded plot. This is at number of particles equal to 10. Epsilon is equal to 0.75. And you can see all these nice convection rolls form.
So these are 2D simulations?
These are 2D simulations.
Is there a boundary at the top?
There is no boundary at the top.
So there's not much of a deformation of the free surface?
This is not a free surface. This is just, there's no boundary at the top, so we plotted the streamlines up to...
You could have plotted higher.
I could have plotted higher. There's no well-defined top. Yeah. We just drew it to coincide with the top streamlines.
So what does happen at the top? Right, there is, in the Ocelot experiments, they have a very distinct free surface.
We don't have a free surface at all. The density just decreases exponentially as you go further and further up. Okay.
And your box is just closed.
It's open at the top.
The top, there's nothing.
There's nothing at the top.
Why does the density decrease exponentially?
Yeah,
it's
exponential. That would be the Boltzmann
result. Right, with particles that dissipate,
because as the density decreases, you approach the ideal gas law, right? P is equal to rho g, and P is equal to...
It's not absolutely clear that the low density limit will recover the ideal gas result even with finite inelasticity. It's an issue of limits.
Yeah, yes, that's true.
You actually see a density that decreases exponentially, at least when you... I would think you'd get a nearly constant density and then some, sort of stuff that trails away, which you could fit to exponential or something, right? Isn't that more likely that there'd be almost a well-defined free surface and then some wave,
that there should be something like free surface.
I'll show you plots of another thing where you can see the actual particles.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay, and if you do it for a lower value of epsilon, you see it's fairly homogeneous. Okay, there's no pattern. Okay. So,
what are the little worms?
The plotting software decided it had to give a few lines. So, okay. If you increase epsilon, you find a larger number of roles within the same space. Okay.
Sorry, I lost you. Epsilon is this thing that's of order 1 minus e, is that right?
Yes.
So increasing epsilon means making more elastic.
Yeah, but it's not exactly 1 minus e, it's actually this thing.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. So.
Sorry, is this one of those streamlines one particle?
No, they're just lines drawn through by interpolating velocity.
Okay, but you only have, n sigma is 10, so how many actual particles are in this thing?
This is 1,500, so 1,500 times n sigma is 10, so 15,000.
Okay.
Okay. And if you make epsilon still larger, then you get, then these patterns break up and you get something that looks more chaotic. But there's no clear peak in the post metal density.
Isn't that from Stephen Wolfram's new book?
Okay. And you can sort of fit this we did theoretically as well. You can sort of fit the wave number 2 square root of 1 minus e square by lambda, where lambda is the mean free path between the particles. Okay, and you get a fairly linear fit. Okay, that's sort of what you'd expect from theoretical considerations.
What theoretical considerations? What?
If you adapt the Rayleigh instability to a compressible gas, uh-huh, and then get the single wavelength out of that.
And that's what you're thinking is happening here. You have this energy input at the bottom.
Yes.
And you have gravity.
Yes. And you can actually...
The bottom wants to be less than...
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, and you can actually see that here. I don't know if you can see that here. This is the mean square velocity. Okay. So you can see that the mean square velocity first decreases and then increases. Okay. So this is a higher temperature. This is a lower temperature. Okay. So that's... So in a continuum limit, that's what's driving the instability. So I mean, that's not really a surprise from a continuum viewpoint. What was more surprising was this kind of phase transition, phase separation instability that we saw when the number of layers was small. Okay, so this is a very wide bed. Okay, and this is a typical thing that you see. Okay, the particle densities. There's no real well-defined surface. Okay, I've just blown up these two ends. Okay. And you can see that in this dilute region, it looks very dense and very much like a liquid. In this region, it looks more like a gas. And what actually happens is that particles enter this region from the top and they come back through the bottom. Okay. So, and this was surprising because you shouldn't have phase transition in hard sphere systems. Okay. So you shouldn't have a coexistence of phases.
This is non-equilibrium and it's inelastic and everything. So I mean,
couldn't this be a steady state version of the inelastic collapse that people have looked at? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we do simulations of 2D driven systems, not necessarily bottom, we find a sort of clustering, but there's not really a phase. There's sort of transient liquid-like cluster, if you like, and it looks a lot like just a steady-state version of inelastic collapse.
What is inelastic collapse?
Inelastic collapse is where you have a dilute gas with finite energy, turn on inelastic collisions, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And the thing,
an ideal system, and then of course it loses energy, but it loses energy in very singular way depending on the concentration.
Okay, so higher concentration,
it either just slows down and stays dilute and uncorrelated, or you'll actually get this singular limit where in a finite period of time there's an infinite number of collisions, mm-hmm, and the energy goes, mm-hmm, to zero and you get these clusters.
Okay.
It's a somewhat idealized thing.
Yeah, it's not clear to me. Yeah,
but it's clear that in a steady state driven system, there is a signature of this inelastic collapse in the form of formation of sort of liquid like clusters, which then dissipate over time.
Okay, if it's a liquid, yeah. Okay.
This doesn't mean.
No, the question is, if it's a liquid like cluster, then let me just go ahead and.
I had one question about this thing. You show something like phase separation.
Yeah.
If it was, I mean, conventionally when you have things that are phase separating, you actually get domains that gradually coarsen, and you know, you get ultimately macroscopic separation, mm-hmm, into, mm-hmm, one high density and one null. Is that, mm-hmm, the final fate of these things in your study also?
Yeah. We do get different regions that do phase separate, but we haven't been able to run it long enough to see them coalesce and stuff like that. So if I do the run with 400 particles, I see nothing. Okay. If I run it with 600 particles, I see that there's a high density here and low density. Okay. If I do it with 7,000 particles, I see regions. Okay.
And using the QE and increasing the number of particles means increasing the
width. Width.
You keep intensive things fixed.
Yes.
I mean, that last one, mm-hmm, you wait longer. Mm-hmm. Does the pattern evolve to having fewer clumps, fewer bumps, or does it just sort of sit there?
It sits there as far as we can see. Okay, we haven't been able to run it long enough to evolve.
I think that question.
Yeah. Well, so here at the bottom, when you sort of have a wavelength,
right?
Yeah.
Is there some scaling that could give you a wavelength? So this is
okay. We've got that. It seems to go as 1 minus e once again, 1/1 minus e once again, but we don't have enough data points to. Say definitely. Okay.
But I imagine there's some sort of correlation, like you get particles that could pop a certain distance over and then they hit this bed of
dense particles, you actually dissipate energy very quickly because you have a huge number of collisions.
Right, but see,
light scale over which that process.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, and if you look at the structure, the dilute region looks, for the pi distribution function, looks like a gas, okay? Whereas the dense region has a liquid-like structure. So it seems like a liquid-gas transition, except that, for one thing, the temperatures are not equal in the two regions, okay? So this is the dense region, and this is a dilute. The velocity distribution function in the dilute region looks very close to a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. In the dense region, it's very different from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Okay, and that seems to be one of the important features. As far as I know, in elastic collapse, they you can for the steady state itself, for a homogeneous cooling state, you can get a scaling whereby the temperature is a function of time and everything depends upon the temperature. Okay. Whereas in this case, it turns out not to be true.
In that homogeneous collapse, in that case, the temperature is a function of time. In practice, if you start to get this clumping, won't it be true that in the high density region, the temperature, the kinetic temperature is lower? In that, not in your thing, in the stuff you're
referring. Yes.
In elastic collapse. So I would guess that you would actually get something like this even there. But
And you could sort of do simple things like. Trying to do a flux balance argument. Okay, so say that there's a dilute region and there's a dense region. There's a flux of particles from the dilute to the dense, flux from the dense to the dilute, and the matching relation between these two will essentially give you the densities of these two states. Okay, that would work only if the flux is goes something like this as a function of number of layers in each region. Okay, it turns out that if you do the usual dense gas theory, this thing is never bends backwards. It's a monotonic function. Okay, so so a simple theory based upon dense gases cannot really give you this kind of behavior. Okay, and the key sort of seems to be in the distribution function, which is not.
Again, under what circumstances do you get a monotone F of n? Is it dense hard sphere gases, and what
hard sphere inelastic gases?
Hard sphere inelastic gases.
Yes, yes.
You can come up. You can construct this object.
Yes. The other thing you can do is you can do simulations of this region alone. Simulations of that region alone. Okay, so take a small number of particles and simulate. There is cut off this and simulate it. Okay, similarly cut this off and simulate it. Then get the flux as a function of density. Okay, even that doesn't seem to work. Okay, so.
Yeah. Where are you? I mean, I'm just a little confused about your phase diagram. Where are the oscillons, and that's a different part of phase space in terms of vibrations or something compared to where you are, where this is happening.
Okay, the oscillons are way off because in oscillons the frequency of the layer vibration is correlated with the frequency of the wall vibration. Okay, so that's way off.
Low frequency.
Okay.
So that's a resonance.
Yeah.
That's a
it is a resonance,
it's
yeah.
A Faraday.
Yeah.
Wind.
Yes.
So you're oscillating much faster than that.
Yeah, the frequency is very high, so the particle particle motion is not correlated with the wall motion.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so the wall basically acts as a source. Okay. And the other problem with this is that we see that the interface seems to fluctuate. Okay? I don't know if you can see it in this figure, but actually if you do a simulation, the position of the interface seems to be fluctuating. Okay? So in that sense, it's different from a steady state you'd get for an inelastic collapse. Okay? Because there the things just keep clumping in. Okay? And the peak frequency does not seem to be correlated with the wall frequency at all. Okay? The frequency at which this interface is fluctuating is much smaller than the frequency of the wall. Okay? So
in your big system, it had like three regions.
Yeah.
And so it didn't change in time.
Yeah.
If I started an initial state where I kind of put all those dense regions together in half the box, and
okay.
I know how much space to fill the dense regions because I got them integrated with those three areas, put them together.
Yeah.
And then the loop for the rest.
Okay.
Is it stable or unstable?
We haven't done all that. Yeah. It's this had like 70,000 particles, I think, and we couldn't do very many simulations in that. But what we do is we uniformly start all simulations with a uniform density across. Okay.
Right, but that's kind of in between the two densities.
Yeah,
so that's unstable.
So, but so that we find is always unstable. Okay, so the original question we sought to answer was that there's a relatively small region where you can actually describe things using simple-minded theories. This convection rho, we can sort of describe it by modifying what is known for the Rayleigh-Bernard convection. But this thing is still a challenge for us. It seems to me that one of the things that inelastic collisions do is produce something like an attractive part of the potential. Again, that is what is leading to all of these coexistences. But it's one has to be careful about that interpretation, because the problems that I've run into as far as interpreting that is that if you look at a pair of particles that are colliding with each other, the pair distribution function is just a function of the distance between the particles. Okay, what seems to be crucial in this case is the fact that particles which are approaching each other approach faster than particles that are going away. Okay, so the pair distribution function itself does not seem to be an adequate representation for these systems. And the pair distribution function has been the basis for all kinds of kinetic theories from the Enskog theory downwards. And I still don't have very good ideas of how to resolve that, but we're sort of working on it. So. The most important slide, the acknowledgements. Thank you.
I actually wonder if there really is a true thermodynamic-like phase diagram for these systems at all, because it might be, for instance, as you, let's see, given that you know that you, from a lot of different studies of these inelastic systems, they do tend to develop spatial correlations. As you make the system larger and larger, you may always, with independent of density, for instance, find some regions that are just slightly dense enough to form a momentary cluster, which may persist for some period of time or something, and then break up. So, in fact, this precise phase boundary in terms of epsilon and density may not really exist. As you go to a big enough system, you may always have clusters. And I mean, admittedly, we've been looking at some somewhat different limit, but we do find that sort of thing. So, and it's a very interesting question whether there's a phase diagram in terms of those two parameters, or whether there's really a finite size dependence as well. I don't have an answer to it. I'm just
okay.
Curious. It's very. I mean, maybe we should compare notes on that.
Okay. I mean, there's some way you got to be able to get at it from the microscopic description, right? If there is.
Well, not yet. Independent of how you approach it theoretically. I mean, is there or is there not phase boundary in the thermodynamic sense? I mean, obviously thermodynamics doesn't rigorously apply here, but
it's a question of steady states, right?
Yes, and it seems my intuition is that. In steady state, you're always going to have cluster formation in a big enough system, simply because you'll have regions with even just momentarily, they pass some density threshold.
See, but I mean, in all of these systems, the dissipation tends to cluster, right? Inelastic collisions tend to cluster particles, but the driving is tending to not. To break up clusters, right? So the balance between the two should be able to tell you, right? In some sense.
Which is also why I don't think these can coarse them either. Right. I think they're actually transient clusters.
Yeah.
So you think the transient clusters transient. Will go away? You think the transient
they're being driven.
No, that's okay.
So they'll be evaporating at the surface, particles will...
No, I mean, it still doesn't
lie. Yeah.
Any of this, it's even in Rayleigh-Bernard, it's driven. So you get a pattern
which stays. Yeah.
I mean, and the pattern is the result of a balance.
Yes. Yes.
Even in ordinary thermodynamic phase separation, it's a balance.
Yes.
So what happens finally depends on which wins.
So is it more like a pattern formation thing, in which case they're fairly stable patterns?
Yeah.
Or are these transient clusters?
Well,
in a sort of steady state version of inelastic collapse.
No, I think as long as the simulations run, they are always present.
And their wavelength doesn't change?
The wavelength doesn't change except for the fluctuating interface. I don't know if I have a figure here.
So if you extended your kinetic theory, maybe homogeneous in the lateral direction, would you see a Rayleigh-Bernard instability?
Or yeah.
Would you see something like that?
You see the Rayleigh-Bernard instability
in the theory capture both the dense and the dilute phases that you see in this other.
No, not this one. No, that's the difficulty we are at right now.
There are a number of people who've been doing vibrating bad single experiments. Mm. Almost several, three or four groups now. Has anybody seen any evidence for, and if not, why not?
For
these local, density fluctuations, and if not, why not? Because is it one of these? I know people are worried about the issue of how actually are the particles. These very simple models of how the particles are being coupled to the base is not exactly right, and so that's one issue. But the question is, are you in a limit that should be explorable?
It should be through
experiments. So what evidence, if any, have they seen for the density fluctuations like this, and if not, why not?
Okay, this convection rule has been seen. Okay, the last I heard, they had only point-wise measurements. They didn't have the whole bed. They were trying to set up some positron emission, something or the other.
You would see these are microscopic ball bearings. You would just see it like you see oscillons.
We actually did a calculation of this phase transition instability, and it turns out that. If you want to actually see this instability in a layer that is if you start with 1 millimeter particles, you'll need a bed that is about 1.5 meters in width. Okay.
You tried it in an experiment or a simulation?
No, from the simulations we tried to calculate what width you'd need in an experiment to see this.
That's what
okay.
I wanted to know.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Yeah.
So. 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 Yeah. So right now, nobody has done gone to that extent.
All right, so okay. Your dense fluctuation regions are such that they're big enough that they would cover, in principle, most of the ball, if you do vibrating ball bearings or something.
Yes.
Maybe 100 or 2, I guess they get maybe 500 or 1,000 wide or something.
Yeah, so, we did the...
We can't do the appreciably smaller particles.
Yeah.
Well, you need to track...
0.1 mm or something.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So nobody has done it on such wide beds to actually see the second one. The first one has been seen in experiments.
Once you go to that big a bed, the slightest gives you gradients, which happens.
Yes.
Has anyone made an annular one? So you said a meter. Okay. So that's. So you can make a bed that's a smaller table that would.
Right. Yeah.
And then you could look at traveling waves. And it's kind of cool to do a
space shuttle.
Oh, there's a
synthetic gravitational field, right? Yeah. Take it up in the space shuttle and then you accelerate the space shuttle.
Yeah, but the convection rule has been seen in simulations as well.
I missed one simple thing. So in the convection case, as distinct from the case, the point is you've got these roll structures where density is pretty much the same from one region to the next, right?
The density is
what you call convection rolls rather than phase separation.
The densities are changing.
What distinguishes the phase separating guy from the convection guy? What properties are different? I didn't understand.
Right, so these are actually density properties.
So you've got density modulation as well as compared.
Yeah, across,
Okay, and in the phase separation one, what's the difference? There's no
velocity. The difference, The difference is that all of this can be well described by kinetic theory with a pair distribution function. Okay, in that case, it cannot. That's the basic difference.
Okay, but if you wrote down instead a coarse grain theory with a concentration and an order parameter for the velocity, okay, in complete ignorance of all other details, do you end up getting both of these? Because I would think that...
The point is that with that kind of description, people have managed to get all these oscillons and stripes and squares and triangles and everything.
Okay, but it still gives you something to compare with. The question is, if you wrote down such a theory, there'd be some generic features of those two so-called phases and transition between them, which maybe you can compare with experiment.
Yeah.
Whereas it might be very hard to get it from kinetic theory.
Yeah, but see, the point is that, there's a variety of theories that can reproduce all the things that are seen in granular flows, right?
Supposing you get a little conservative and say you'll write down sort of the most economical, simplest kinetic theory where there is some kind of convection velocity as an order parameter, and there is a density, and you write down things that are allowed and in a gradient expansion.
Okay.
Because then you can start to answer questions about, at least within that theory, whether phase separation is real phase separation or just some other kind of stripe formation. There's lots of things you can try to answer with that. And see, I mean, look at it this way. It's, if you're trying to understand hydrodynamic instabilities, actually kinetic theory is a very hard way to do it.
Yes.
Right, and if you just
view
of hydrodynamic instabilities. Right. In fact, what you end up resorting to is, I mean, there you're lucky, you have the hydrodynamic equations. You don't have that here, but in this situation,
yeah.
Isn't there some point in saying that you've got a thin layer, right? And therefore, at large lateral length scales, the fact that there's momentum conservation internally is not all that important. Number conservation is important, and there's an order parameter whose concept you're trying to describe.
See, but somehow you've got to couple the velocity back to the order parameter field, right?
Sure,
somehow.
On symmetry grounds, there will be relatively few ways with small numbers of gradients that you can write down such couplings. It might not be that hopeless. So, and it might not be that arbitrary also.
But I mean, it seems to me that, you know, you can always write it down to get any pattern that you want.
I think that's being a little unfair to the non-logical theories. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, but you could analyze things like the stability of an interface, for instance. Very basic things like that would be.
And I think. It's useful and valid to do both. So I was just wondering what those theories say about this, or it's not been tried for your patterns.
For my patterns, it's not been tried. Straight for these oscillons and stuff, and they get everything. I mean, they get square stripes, the whole works. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they also get phase boundaries at appropriate parameter values. But those parameter values are some parameters you put into that Landau-Ginzburg equation.
Figuring out how those are written, right. Topics is another story.
Yeah. So, so in that sense, this these things are universal, right? So,
in particular, to understand whether what you see as phase separation, you know, to answer Fred's question, whether it is actually phase separation,
or just
a slight variation on what you had in the convection.
Okay. Yeah, I call it phase separation for want of a better word, basically.
No, it's not. There's no reference to thermodynamics. It's phase separation if at long times you just get, it may be very slow, but you eventually get one dense region and one rarefied region.
Yeah.
If that happens, it's fair to call it phase separation. It doesn't imply any underlying thermodynamics. And it's perfect. It could be perfectly real.
Yeah, but.
So that's why I was wondering.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
analysis of this sort we'll try.
Yeah, well, I don't have an intuition on that. It's basically, as long as we let the computer run, it stays. So. I don't know further how to.
Yeah.